What causes, say, heroin addiction? This is a really stupid question, right? It's obvious. We all know it. Heroin causes heroin addiction.
Nick, you don't mind if I get a cigarette?
And then she reached into her clever little purse shaped like a flightless bird, and she pulled out a clean needle and some clean, fresh heroin, and with a little smile, she injected it right into her bare little arm. This was a new twist. I felt myself go all cold and soft. I hated needles, and, oh yeah, did I mention? She had a gun trained on me.
Ah, oh, that's better. I'm going away, Nick. Far away from here. Just stay where you are.
Okay, okay, baby.
Oh, that's a whole lot better.
Here's how it works. If you use heroin for 20 days, by day 21, your body would physically crave the drug ferociously because there are chemical hooks in the drug. That's what addiction means. But there's a catch. Almost everything we think we know about addiction is wrong.
Our forefathers took drugs. Your brain is not the boss.
Yes, yes, yes,
that's right.
Everything you know is wrong.
If you, for example, break your hip, you'll be taken to a hospital and you'll be given loads of diamorphine for weeks or even months. Diamorphine is heroin. It's in fact much stronger heroin than any addict can get on the street because it's not contaminated by all the stuff drug dealers loot it with. There are people being given loads of deluxe heroin in hospitals right now. So at least some of them should become addicts. But this has been closely studied. It doesn't happen. Your grandmother wasn't turned into a junkie by her hip replacement. Why is that?
Why should all the junk pass through the hands of the junkies? That's what I want to know. I mean, how much junk do you need before you can turn on?
It depends on your metabolism.
Listen, you use your common sense. It all helps, but the more junk you have, naturally, the more efficiently the collectors can operate in your neighborhood. If you don't have enough junk of your own...
You go crazy!
No, you form a neighborhood pool.
Yep, yeah, what is the... This sounds a bit extravagant.
Well, no, you dig
You have to have a pool. Why do the junkies have to have pools? We give them dope, for God's sake.
Because of the hummingbirds and the mold on the bushes, that's why.
Too cold to swim anyway.
Our current theory of addiction comes in part from a series of experiments that were carried out earlier in the 20th century. The experiment is simple. You take a rat and put it in a cage with water bottles. One is just water, the other is water laced with heroin or cocaine. Almost every time you run this experiment, the rat will become obsessed with the water and keep coming back for more and more until it kills itself.
When you can't stand the pace in the big rodent race, come on in where it's safe, where the menu is trade. There's a smell in the air that reminds you. You've got something to get, and it looks like you're paying.
Aren't you hungry?
First we take some rat parts and fry them up real nice. Then we skin the kitties and barbecue the mice.
Guts in a cup, yum! Mouse on a stick, wow!
French fried fleas and beer battered
hits. Fried in a bun.
We fry what you want.
But in the 1970s, Bruce Alexander, a professor of psychology, noted something odd about this experiment. The rat is put in the cage all alone. It has nothing to do but take the drugs. What would happen, he wondered, if we tried this differently? So he built Rat Park, which is basically heaven for rats.
Happy New Year, little rat. How I wonder where you at? Frying in a plane, you sing like a sparrow in a Peking.
Now, let me show you this, my fellow merkins. And let me say, in all humbleness, or rather, let me wish, for all merkins have wishes, hopes, and screams. Dreams! Let me... Because I am the president. Let me repeat as I've repeated so many times before. It will be a good, prosperous, and happy new year, the year of the new rat.
Rat! There's rats in the kitchen cabinet!
I say, my man, has you heard the rats has got the vote?
Oh no, I'm gonna have to go tell my wife!
It's a lush cage where the rats would have colored balls, tunnels to scamper down, plenty of friends to with, and they could have loads of sex. Everything a rat of a town could want. And they would have the drugged water and the normal water bottles. But here's the fascinating thing. In Rat Park, rats hardly ever use the drugged water. None of them ever use it compulsively. None of them ever overdose. But maybe this is a quirk of rats, right? Well, helpfully, there was a human experiment along the same lines. The Vietnam War. 20% of American troops in Vietnam were using a lot of heroin. People back home were really panicked because they thought there would be hundreds of thousands of junkies on the streets of the United States when the war was over.
Uh-oh, broken neighbor's window, gotta play for school, didn't eat your breakfast, cracked on daddy's chair, showed your dork at recess, wee-weed in the pool, you're in a peck of trouble but you just don't care. Oh, you're chewing your bubble, oh, blow away your trouble, oh, you're glad that you picked it and now you're addicted, rococo bubble, oh, opium gum.
But a study followed the soldiers home and found something striking. They didn't go to rehab. They didn't even go into withdrawal. 95% of them just stopped after they got home. Do you believe the old theory of addiction? That makes no sense. But if you believe Professor Alexander's theory, it makes perfect sense. Because if put into a horrific jungle in a foreign country where you don't want to be, could be forced to die at any moment, doing heroin is a great way to spend your time. But if you go to your nice home with your friends and your family, it's the equivalent of being taken out of that first cage and put in human park. It's not the chemicals, it's your cage. We need to think about addiction differently. Human beings have an innate need to bond and connect. When we are happy and healthy, we bond with the people around us. But when we can't, because we're traumatized, isolated, or been down in life, we will bond with something that gives us some sense of relief. It might be endless checking a smartphone, it might be pornography, video games, Reddit, gambling. Or it might be coquette.
First go, rat about in the cupboard and see old man.
Well, I'll get the old army tray. We've been gone, you know. Probably spoiled.
Hello, what's this? This solution's too blue. Not quite as I expected. That means the rat should have lived and the captain should have died, of course. Let's see. Novitratus noveticus as mammalia. Rodentia. Here we are. Black and brown. It's electricity.
I've got everything but this often of Uncle Sigmund's Peruvian cocoa powder.
That'll be all right. Did you know, Flotsam, that if rats were the size of English children, they could wipe us out in a week?
Oh, I don't want to hear about it.
But we will bond with something, because that is our human nature. The path out of unhealthy bonds is to form healthy bonds, to be connected to people you want to be present with. Addiction is just one symptom of the crisis of disconnection that's happening all around us. We all feel it. Since the 1950s, the average number of close friends an American has been steadily declining. At the same time, the amount of floor space in their homes has been steadily increasing. To choose floor space over friends, to choose stuff over connection. The war on drugs we've been fighting for almost a century now has made everything worse. Instead of helping people heal and getting their life together, we have cast them out from society. We have made it harder for them to get jobs and become stable. We take benefits and support away from them if we catch them with drugs. We throw them in prison cells, which are literally cages. We put people who are not well in a situation that makes them feel worse and hate them for not recovering. For too long, we've talked only about individual recovery from addiction. But we need now to talk about social recovery, because something has gone wrong with us as a group. We have to build a society that looks a lot more like Rat Park and a lot less like those isolated cages. We are going to have to change the unnatural way we live and rediscover each other. The opposite of addiction is not sobriety. The opposite of addiction is connection.
And he started giving it to me and giving it to this one and giving it to that one. And at first it was just disgusting how you feel. And it's just
puking,
so horrible.
I
think I'll never do this again.
Yeah, yeah.
And then one night your nerves shot.
Yeah.
And you say, oh,
need a bump.
Okay, yeah, yeah, yeah. And down, down, down you go.
Yeah,
you
yeah, know? Yeah.
And that became something to wrestle with. That started a late 70, early 71 for me. And I think the last time I ever messed with that, it took about 10 years. I never joined, Jesus.
Right.
Nah.
Jesus, this is Iggy.
Yeah, right. Nah, I just sort of gradually, my tastes moved in other directions. And for that reason, it took a long time, but I'm a lot more solid.
Yeah.
I don't have to go to a meeting and find God to just am the way I am.
But it was a fight, though.
It kept coming back, and if it wasn't that, it would be like 10 bottles of wine or a bunch of pills or a bunch of Coke or methadone or silly little weird shit.
This was during the prime time of when
of
you...
Of my career. Yeah. I did a lot of good stuff under the influence. Listen, I know.
Hi, mothers.
Hi, others.
We's the Pills Brothers. I'm Red.
And I's Poible.
You know, there's good drugs.
And there's bad drugs.
And there's times for using them.
And there's times for not using them.
And hey, brother, we're gonna use some right now.
If you swallow the precinct, you can apply for further information and free samples from the present all-night drug abuse council.
Acceleration equals 16 GT squared. And
what
I just
does that
thought,
mean?
Well, I don't know. I just thought that ever since I was in high school, I was always told that you can accelerate faster, or you can go
you mean,
farther.
How about some, I got some whiteies.
Give me those whiteies. I'll tell
some
you about Ohm's
whiteies.
Law.
Okay. You want some blackies?
I got a couple of
give
blackies.
Give me a couple of
black widows.
Take it down a little bit, yeah. Some yellows.
Just a couple of yellows.
Yellows?
Couple
okay,
yellows.
Okay, here we go.
A bunch of Chicanos.
Yeah, all right.
Okay, man.
All right.
Here, have some brownies.
I have some brownies, too, huh? That's good drugs.
Okay, with us today as an expert on drug abuse, Peter Keschner. Peter? Peter has been an expert on drug abuse for many years. He was with the Drug Abuse Council. He's taken more drugs than any police officer, you think, in the world. Mr. Keschner? Can you tell us about, by golly, this is one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. Do you always wear that hat, Mr. Keschner? That's, I think you'd call that far out, right? Okay, now as a police officer.
Oh, no!
Well, okay, in your police work. Well, as a narcotics control officer,
We better take a break for the news.
Hi, I'm the Everly brother, and in our business we hear a lot of talk about drugs. The heavy message now is that speed kills. It refers to a group of drugs called amphetamines, including ups, pep pills, meth, dex, even bennies. You've seen what speed drugs can do. They're dangerous, much too dangerous to fool around with. To find out more about drugs, write the National Institute of Mental Health with it. Address Box 101, Washington, D.C. Don't get the fuck out of here!
This is Ray Manzarek of The Doors. That white powder called speed is a real bummer. It's a one-way death trip for kids who really don't know what they're getting into. Don't let someone talk you into shooting it. It'll kill you. That's the way it works. It'll just kill you. Put speed down.
Well, friends, I've been talking with my friends down at the Anti-Speed Committee. And we've all decided that there's got to be something bad in the age of Aquarius. So we've decided that it's going to be speed, because we don't make much profit off that drug. Oh, we make our profit off bigger drugs, health food stores, Der Wiener schnitzels on Indian reservations. For the first time, bringing liberal American culture and a hint of black studies to people who were just all red before.
I've come to talk to you about addiction, the power of addiction, but also addiction to power. As a medical doctor, I work in Vancouver, Canada, and I've worked with some very, very addicted people. People who use heroin, they inject cane, they drink alcohol, crystal meth, and every drug known to man. And these people suffer. If the success of a doctor is to be measured by how long his patients live, then I'm a failure, because my patients die very young, relatively speaking. They die of HIV, they die of hepatitis C, they die of infections of their heart valves, they die of infections of their brains, of their spine, of their hearts, of their bloodstream. They die of suicide, of overdose, of violence, of accidental deaths. And if you look at them, you call to mind the words of the great Egyptian novelist Naguib Mahfouz, who wrote, "Nothing records the effects of a sad life as graphically as the human body," because these people lose everything. They lose their health, they lose their beauty, they lose their teeth, they lose their wealth, they lose human relationship, and in the end, they often lose their lives. And yet nothing shakes them from their addiction. Nothing can force them to give up their addiction. The addictions are powerful, and the question is why? And as one of my patients said to me, "I'm not afraid of dying," he said, "I'm more afraid of living." And the question to ask is, why are people afraid of life? And if you want to understand addiction, you can't look at what's wrong with the addiction, you have to look at what's right about it. In other words, what is the person getting from the addiction? What are they getting that otherwise they don't have? And what addicts get are relief from pain. What they get is a sense of peace, a sense of control.
Phew, they've all gone. Madge, will you help me put the chicken a la king back in the fridge?
Honestly, Joyce, I don't know where you get the energy. 14 children, president of the World Bank, and you still find time to make the best buffet in Fresno. I can remember when the least little problem put you right to sleep.
Not anymore, Madge. Not since I discovered a simple little pill called methadrine.
Methadrine. Available without a prescription at drug centers everywhere. Remember, methadrine carries the seal of approval of the Armenian Medical Association.
A sense of calmness, very, very temporarily. And the question is, why are these qualities missing from their lives? What happened to them? Now, if you look at the drugs like heroin, like morphine, like codeine, if you look at cocaine, if you look at alcohol, these are all painkillers. One way or another, they all soothe pain. And that's what the real question in addiction is, not why the addiction, but why the pain. Now, I just finished reading the biography of Keith Richards, the guitarist for the Rolling Stones. And as you probably know, everybody's still surprised that Richards is still alive today, because he was a heavy-duty heroin addict for a long time. And in his biography, he writes that the addiction was all about looking for oblivion, looking for forgetting. He said, the contortions that we go through just not to be ourselves for a few hours. And I understand that very well myself, because I know that discomfort with myself. I know that discomfort being in my own skin. I know that desire to escape from my own mind. The great British psychiatrist, R.D. Lang said that there are three things that people are afraid of. They're afraid of death, of other people, and their own minds. And for a long time in my life, I wanted to distract myself from my own mind because I was afraid to be alone with it. And how would I distract myself? Well, I've never used drugs, but I've distracted myself through work and throwing myself into activity. And I've distracted myself through shopping. In my case, for classical compact music, classical compact discs. But I've been a real addict that way. One week I spent $8,000 on the classical compact discs, not because I wanted to, but because I couldn't help going back to the store. And as a medical doctor, I used to deliver a lot of babies, and once I left a woman in labor in hospital to get a classical piece of music. And I still could have made it back to the store, to the hospital on time, but once in the store, you can't leave because there is evil classical music dealers in the aisles, you know, who, "Hey, buddy, have you listened to the latest Mozart symphony cycle? You haven't?" Well, so I missed the delivery of that baby. And I'd come home and I'd lie to my wife about it, like any addict. I would lie about it. And I would ignore my own children because of my obsession with work and with music. So I know what that escape from the self is like. And my definition of addiction is any behavior that gives you temporary relief, temporary pleasure, but in the long term causes harm, has some negative consequences, and you can't give it up despite those negative consequences. And from that perspective, you can understand that there's many, many addictions. Yes, there's the addiction to drugs, but there's also the addiction to consumerism. There's the addiction to sex, to the internet, to shopping, to food. The Buddhists have this idea of the hungry ghosts. The hungry ghosts are creatures with large empty bellies and small scrawny necks and tiny little mouths, so they can never get enough. They can never feel this emptiness on the inside. And we all hungry ghosts in this society. We all have this emptiness. And so many of us are trying to fill that emptiness from the outside. And the addiction is all about trying to fill that emptiness from the outside.
Who was that lady I saw you with last night?
Oh, that was no lady. That was Bottles.
Bottles? I got so I'd drink anything. After that, I just couldn't seem to get off this stuff. My whole career went up in smoke.
Listen, this bar doesn't serve anything but 69-cent bar scotch. That's all you get here.
It's good?
It's terrible.
I tell you something. I took 43 drinks waiting to get on a plane from Burbank to Oxnard yesterday.
Yeah, I've waited down. That's at Interplanetary Airport Central,
Contrapole. Yeah, well, it's as close as possible to where I live, if you want to call that a living.
I understand. 65 drinks you took.
48, actually.
That was a good year for bar scotch.
I was absolutely destroyed. I got up to 20,000 feet, and I began to see people with weapons in the plane. Well, they were there, of course.
Oh, well.
But you can't see them until you get that.
All right, is everybody here now? I think we can begin. The president has asked us...
President?
...to write...
God bless the president.
All right, Fred, I know we
God
all
God bless the president.
All right. Please, gentlemen. Gentlemen, please. Is this microphone on here, please? The president has asked us to communicate with those countries who are presently growing marijuana and poppies. I know, Jimmy, that you're going to say that the artificial poppies that you give out as part of the veterans program will be affected by this. It is not true. You cannot smoke those.
No, we never.
They are inflammable, as a matter of fact. We never. Can you turn his microphone on?
Thank
you
very
much.
Thank you, Senator.
As we never have we never smoke any of those poppies at all. They're for medicinal purposes and are to be swallowed whole, anyway, except for the little seed. I think we should all get behind this effort and push him over the top and get these countries, these nasty countries, to stop growing this stuff so that we can get a market on it here at home. I think that Lucky Strike Green is going to hit the streets, right? Keep the problem in the pockets of the businessmen. That's what I say. You better believe it, friend. And let's back the president all the way up there.
I backed him yesterday into the swimming pool, and I nearly lost all of my senatorial privileges. For example, I can't go to the electric wee-wee room anymore.
Yes.
Oh, that's since the French have come, right?
Yes.
Ever since they started speaking German on the first floor, I can't get anything worthwhile to eat except a little beer brat.
Have any of you tried to run the maze on the fifth floor?
No.
I can't. They wouldn't give me a key to the fifth floor.
That's where they keep the secretary.
I live in an office that used to be Ralph Nader's.
Oh, no, really? That is a Nader. That's a pun. Oh, I'm sorry.
All right, gentlemen, I think that's really enough for today. Let's all retire into the retirement room and have a little drinky-drink.
And then we look at the drug addict, and we say to the drug addict, how can you possibly do this to yourself? How can you possibly inject this terrible substance into your body that may kill you? But look at what we're doing to the earth. Rejecting all kinds of things into the atmosphere and the oceans and the environment that is killing us, that's killing the earth. Now, which addiction is greater? The addiction to oil or to consumerism? Which causes the greater harm? And yet we judge the drug addict because we actually see that they're just like us, and we don't like that. So we say, you're different from us. You're worse than we are. On the plane to Sao Paulo and Rio de Janeiro, I was reading the New York Times on June the 9th, and it was an article about Brazil. And the article was about a man called Nigio Gomes, a leader of the Guarani people in the Amazon, who was killed last November. And you probably heard about him. And he was killed because he was protecting his people from the big farmers and companies that are taking over the rainforest and destroying the rainforest, and they're destroying the habitat of the native Indian people here in Brazil. And I can tell you that coming from Canada, the same thing has happened over there. And many of my patients were actually First Nations Indian people, Native Indian people in Canada. And they are heavily addicted. They make up a small percentage of the population, but they make up a large percentage of the people in jail, the people who are addicted, the people who are mentally ill, the people who commit suicide. Why? Because the lands were taken away from them, and because they were killed and abused for generations, generations, and generations. But the question I ask is, if you can understand the suffering of these native people and how that suffering makes them seek relief from pain in their addictions, what about the people who are perpetrating it? What are they addicted to? Well, they're addicted to power. They're addicted to wealth. They're addicted to acquisition. They want to make themselves bigger. And when I was trying to understand the addiction to power, I looked at some of the most powerful people in history. I looked at Alexander the Great. I looked at Napoleon. I looked at Hitler. I looked at Genghis Khan. I looked at Stalin. It's very interesting when you look at these people. First of all, why did they need power so much? Interestingly enough, physically, they were all very small people, my size, or smaller, actually smaller. They came from outsiders. They were not part of the major population. Stalin was a Georgian, not a Russian. Napoleon was a Corsican, not a Frenchman. Alexander was a Macedonian, not a Greek. And Hitler was an Austrian, not a German. So a real sense of insecurity and inferiority. And they needed power to feel okay in themselves, to make themselves bigger. And in order to get that power, they're quite willing to fight wars and to kill a lot of people just to maintain that power. I'm not saying that only small people can be power hungry, but it's interesting to look at these examples, because power, the addiction to power, is always about the emptiness that you try and fill from the outside. And Napoleon, even in exile on the island of St. Helena after he lost power, he said, "I love power. I love power." He couldn't think of himself without power. He had no sense of himself without being powerful externally. And that's very interesting when you compare it to people like the Buddha or Jesus. Because if you look at the story about Jesus and Buddha, both of them were tempted by the devil. And one of the things that the devil offers them is power, earthly power. And they both say no. Now, why do they say no? They say no because they have the power inside of themselves. They don't need it from the outside. And they both say no because they don't want to control people. They want to teach people. They want to teach people by example and by soft words and by wisdom, not through force. So they refuse power. And it's very interesting what they say about that. Jesus says that the power and the reality is not outside of yourself, but inside. He says the kingdom of God is within. And the Buddha, before he dies and his monks are mourning and crying and they're all upset, he says, "Don't mourn me," he says, "and don't worship me. Find the lamp inside yourself. Be a lamp unto yourselves. Find the light within." And so as we look at this difficult world with the loss of the environment and the global warming and the depredations in the oceans, let's not look to the people in power to change things. Because the people in power, I'm afraid to say, are very often some of the emptiest people in the world. And they're not going to change things for us. We have to find that light within ourselves. We have to find the light within communities. And with our, in our own wisdom, in our own creativity. We can't wait for the people in power to make things better for us, because they're never going to, not unless we make them. Now, they say that human nature is competitive, that human nature is aggressive, that human nature is selfish. It's just the opposite. Human nature is actually cooperative. Human nature is actually generous. Human nature is actually community-minded. What we see here at this conference, with people sharing information, people receiving information, people committed to the better world, that's actually human nature. And what I'm saying to you is, if we find that light within, if we find our own nature, then we'll be kinder to ourselves, and we'll also be kinder to nature. Thank you.
We wrote this piece based on the concept of people oppressed by power, any power, any political authority, any governmental authority, any dictatorship, any kind, anybody telling you basically what to do and how to do it, just control. And I think that one of the first things we agreed on in our brainstorming sessions was that we would begin the record and end the record in a loop. I don't know if we decided exactly how we were going to do that, but I know that that was very appealing to us all. And this being the first project that we had ever really written together, you know, all of the other work that we did together was improvisational, so that we'd each come in with we'd agree on the assignment of what it was we were going to portray, and then each one of us would work independently to create a character or characters that would embody some aspect of the idea, and then we would all live on the radio reveal our characters to one another, and out of that would come usually some pretty entertaining interaction, always based on the art of put-on. And in fact, to me, the Fire Sign Theater in essence represents the art of put-on carried to the ultimate degree in terms of its theatricality or improvisation, because I remember that no matter how far out we would carry a premise when we were working on the radio, if we were tied into any phone lines and we could get input from the audience, we discovered that the audience would go way out there with us. As long as they bought the initial premise, we could take them as far into outer space as we wanted to. We could be as outrageous in the ideas and characters we were portraying as we wanted to be, and they believed us. Now, that was both a wonderful and terrifying revelation, because it showed me, at least, and I think you too, David, I can perhaps speak for all of us, it showed us the awesome power of the radio. It showed us the extent to which people were, well, either using drugs or just plain brainwashed, and how they would basically follow any line that you threw them. So a lot of electrician, to me, at least the flip side of the record, the main part of the story, comes out of that kind of thinking and a desire on our part to break the hold of that kind of thinking on the body politic, on the people who make up a nation or a country or a city or a neighborhood, so that they start thinking for themselves and realizing that they basically can appreciate a life of freedom if they choose to live such a life.
Caminho de ferro, mandaram arrancar, velho maquinista. Thank you.